Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, and welcome to The Body Protest.
In this podcast, we combine storytelling with science to better understand how we think, feel, and relate to our bodies. I'm Nadia Craddock, and I'm a body image researcher.
And I'm Honey Ross, writer and activist. This podcast is brought to you by The Pink Protest.
Hi, honey. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good today, Nadia. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm really trying not to always answer that question by saying I'm tired, which is like my instinctual, honest reaction. But I kind of feel like I'm turning into my father. So
when people say I'm good, I just assume that also means I'm tired. Because when I said I'm good, what I actually meant was I'm tired.
I know. And it always makes me think of that Hannah Gadsby line where she's like, I identify as tired.
No, truly. Yes. To my core.
I know.
Someone said to me the other day, they were like, I turned 16 and felt tired and then just never felt not tired. And I was like, ouch. Ow.
I know. The struggle to feel refreshed.
It's real. Anyway.
Anyway. I am very excited for this episode. It's the last one that we recorded in the before times, so pre-pandemic.
We spoke to Mary Higgins and Elle Potter, who we refer to as the Hotter Girls. Obviously, you can combine the names and it's great. We love it. Higgins and Potter. My mind is jelly today.
Do you know what? I don't think I even knew that.
No!
I must have done.
It's very good.
That feels new.
Well, I'm very excited that I got to give that to you because I was like, obviously, I'm saying everybody knows it. But I'm obsessed with them. They're so fantastic. They're just such incredible, young, funny, talented queer women. And my amazing friend Georgie took me to see their show at the Soho Theatre last year. And everyone in the audience was weeping and dancing, and it was the most special celebration of all different forms of womanhood. We're going to talk about that, but Elle and Mary have created a really special show called Hotter, where they, you know, interviewed such a wide range of women, and it was a really special theatre experience, which is also one of the reasons why, God, can't wait for COVID to be done so we can go to the theatre again, because, wow, really miss it.
I know, and I'm so sad that I never got to see their shows, and they actually had two because there was Hotter and then there was a follow-up called Fitter. But what I can say is that they were a delight to chat with. We spoke about their relationship together, we spoke about their shows, obviously, we spoke about their relationship with their bodies growing up. I think we do touch on eating disorders, though, just as a flag in case you're vulnerable to that. But it's a really sweet conversation, and as I say, it was a delight in that before time.
I know, simpler times. And if you'd like to catch the girls and see what they're doing now, obviously theatres are not going, but they have put out a radio play, Lemon Ginge, a queer fairy tale that we will link to in the show notes. And also, I think this was recorded around a time I was cat sitting for some friends, so you might hear some very intense cats in the background. But if not, hope you enjoy the episode.
Why don't we start with you two introducing yourselves?
I'm Elle Potter.
I'm Mary Higgins.
And together, we are Hotter. Is the name of our two person.
I want to just clarify that Elle was looking at Mary expectantly to say it at the same time, and she did not oblige.
Totally.
I think it's important to make that clear. It was really sad to watch, I'm going to be honest. I'm devastated.
I haven't even ever felt that before. No, it's fine. The reason why we're called Hotter is because our surnames combine to make the word hotter. It was a really convenient, like, dramaturgical jumping off point that our surnames combined to make the word hotter. Because, like, we also wanted to make a show about bodies.
Yeah.
But it was coincidence.
Did you always know you wanted to make a show about bodies?
This is what I always say. It's a bit like one of those apps
where, you know, you can guess your child by blending your faces.
Yes.
But it's, like, sort of like that. And it's probably not an accurate representation of your child, but it's, like, quite a good starting point.
Yeah.
So I think just by, like, blending our brains and faces, we were like, it's probably going to be about bodies, weren't
yeah
they?
We basically went into the deep end. Mary was like, do you want to make a show with me? And I was like, who are you? But also yes. And then, like, we sort of cut all the initial stage of friendship thing and we're like, jump straight in with, what is your worst fear about your body and the way you look?
Wow. So, and, like, basically, really went in deep.
Yeah, from the start, we were both just going through a part in our lives. Just
what was the main thing we were thinking about?
We were just thinking about our bodies all the time. I've always had quite a, complicated relationship with my body. And also at the time of my sexuality. So I was like, and Mary was outwardly queer and proud. And so we spent a lot of time
still
talking
baby,
about.
Though.
Yeah, yeah. But not afraid in the way that I was at the time.
No, and so I spent, knew you were queer.
Yeah, I know. I did have a shaved head at the time, so.
Which is, I always,
a boyfriend.
Yeah.
And shaved also, head and the boyfriend.
So it was, like, cognitively.
So mixed signals, really, yeah.
Boyfriend but shaved head. And yeah, so we spent a lot of time talking about our own bodies and sexualities. And then as a natural progression from that, we started sleeping with each other.
Wonderful.
That's always the way.
Of the genre.
With your, you said you had a complicated relationship with your body. Did that intertwine with your sexuality and that, or were they quite distinct?
Oh yeah, they were. It was definitely combined, because I think my relationship with my body has always been slightly complicated by the fact I have an identical twin. So I, like, grew up with, like, someone who had exactly the same body as me, and, like, puberty is fucking difficult to go through anyway. And then when you have, like, your mirror image,
you have a direct comparison,
yeah, going through at the same time, and you're, like, comparing yourself all the time to, like, the literal genetic identical version of you. And at the same time, I read Freud on homosexuality, which famously he compares homosexuality, he says it's like a base form of narcissism, and you're basically seeking yourself in another person, you're looking for your mirror image. And I was like, oh my god, I'm not only gay, but I'm also incestuous, and I, like, have, and so it was like a melting pot of problems with, like, my body, and then also seeing it mirrored in someone else's, and then, like, not feeling comfortable with my sexuality, all in one, because of fucking Freud.
Yeah, I think that they have such a definitive link for me. Like, I always say that if I hadn't realised that I was attracted to women, I'd probably still have an eating disorder, or, like, a worse version of it, because just before I realised I, like, fancied a girl, I had, like, big trouble with, like, eating, and just desperate to be the sort of boniest version of myself. And then the first, like, girl I fell for, just, like, what I fell for in her, among other things, was, like, I remember being, like, really moved by basically, like, tiny muffin top. Like, I remember seeing, like, I mean,
it is delightful.
It's delightful.
It's lovely.
It's, like, so, it's just, like, yeah, so gorgeous. But, like, knowing that if I, and this is, like, a sort of horrible thing to say, but if I had it on myself, I would freak out. I definitely would then. But then I was really attracted to it in someone else. Whereas I think prior to that, my eating disorder was being fed by the sort of fake news that the tinier I was, the more desirable I was, and, like, that's what men wanted, and, like, and that's what I desired in men. I was very, like, hard line, like, very judgmental, I think, of, like, the male form then. So if someone was heavier, I didn't find them attractive, and I was sort of buying into the whole, like, hetero vibe of, like, we've all just got to be, like, lean machines. And then that was taken down when I was like, oh no, but I fancy fat on women, which means that, like, that means people could fancy that on me. That means that it's not about what... Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say, that my attraction to men aligns with, like, who you're meant to be attracted to in the, like, most, like, hetero-capitalist form. And then my attraction to women just breaks all the rules. And, like, it's never who I think it's going to be. And the bodies are so different from mine. And actually, it's like fuck Freud, it's the opposite of like someone that looks like me. It's actually often really different.
I was going to say it's almost a polar opposite experience that you both had in kind of discovering your queerness.
Well, I think that was the kind of intellectual view I had of it when I was like growing up at age like 15, when I was starting to like come to terms with my sexuality or like thinking about it probably for the first time. And it was like so easy to just like read the words of like a dead white man and be like, well, he must be right, you know,
if because people like take him people read him and blah, blah, blah.
But then the lived experience I had was that like the first Mary was the first girl I slept with. And it was the first time someone, instead of like ignoring my belly, you know, like sort of acting like it wasn't there.
The elephant in the room.
Yeah, that's exactly. I'd always be like, if I don't mention it, you know, I'm thinking about it nonstop, but at least like they haven't mentioned it. Like, so like,
it's probably,
and like I would almost like convulse if like anyone touched it in a kind of sexual way. Like my experience sleeping with Mary those first times was like you like praised my body to an extent that I had never experienced before, and like my belly was beautiful, and I'd like had never conceived of that any belly could be beautiful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you sang a lyric into my belly button from Rye, a song called Open.
Which is in Booksmart.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And we had this mad moment. You know, that is the song that accompanies the moment when there's like that queer.
It goes like this, wait. I'm a fool for your belly.
Yeah. You know the bit in the film?
In the bathroom.
Yeah. Anyway, Elle and I watched it separately, but we could not believe they played that song because it was like the song I think I played it the first time we had sex.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
So it was first queer sex and it was the same song. And we were both like,
but the thing is, I was like in the we went to, I wish we'd seen the film together, but in a way it was amazing to be like I think I went and watched it by myself or like with people who like maybe didn't know me as well. I just burst into tears when I heard that song being played in that context. Like even though it's really quite, you know, it's not really tear-jerk worthy in the film as a standalone thing, but I'm sure everyone around was like, why is she okay? Like, this isn't the sad bit. Like,
well, this is sex.
I have to say, watching Booksmart, there were so many moments in it which aren't sad or emotional scenes, but I had never seen that done on screen before. Like, I'd never seen, like, such a real queer love scene. I'd never seen such a brutal, also I'd never seen like just a plus size woman on screen.
Yeah.
Just beautiful and it's never acknowledged. And it's not part of the literally the minute I saw Beanie on screen, I burst into tears and was like, if I'd seen this as a teenager, my whole life would have been different. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like it would have completely changed everything.
The thing is like Booksmart starts where so many things end. Like normally the narrative of people who are like queer or are fat, basically the story ends with them coming to terms with their body, and the whole story is about the strife of like getting there.
Yeah.
Whereas Booksmart is like you've got two incredible female characters on screen. One of them is queer, one of them is fat, and they already love themselves. Yeah. Like that is never doubted in the film. They like start from there and then the rest is just their life.
So Mary and Elle have created two very special shows. One is called Hotter, one is called Fitter. I took my mum to see Hotter the other day and I was going to mention this, which is she, one, burst into tears. Like, I've never seen her cry at theatre. My mum usually hates the theatre, like, actively is like, I don't want to go. I told her she had to go. She burst into tears and then she went, I've never seen anything so honest.
Oh.
And she was like, your generation is so special because the honesty and the power of what you two are doing. I mean, and I felt the same when I saw your show. My friend took me, and then the very next day I was like, I have to take my best friend, and I booked another ticket, which is now why I feel so creepy, because every time you are in the audience, you're like, please, I hope Honey's not there. Like, if I see her in the audience, I'm going to scream. But I love the show so much. I think it's so important. I think, you know, I really... Are you going to bring it back? Sorry, just for me, personally, so I can go again, obviously.
Yeah, there will.
Yeah.
It will be back.
It's coming back in one form or another.
Yeah.
One thing I love, and I feel like we've already kind of broached this, is just you two are so comfortable talking about things that I think have traditionally been taboo. I mean, like, just the way you're so open about masturbation, the way you're so open about periods. I love you talking about periods dripping on your white shoes, and I just was like, yes, it's so real, it's so true. Even talking about menopause, which is one of the reasons I took my mum, because I think there's so many women in that generation who are going through menopause who have never spoken about it, never heard anyone speak about it. What made you want to broach those subjects?
We had a thing about the embarrassed, like what makes people embarrassed, and that being about silence, because you can't really be embarrassed about something if the person next to you knows exactly what you're talking about. Like, it only comes, mm-hmm. that feeling, that particularly, like, it's so, also embarrassment has such a strong link to teenage, being teenage, mm-hmm. I think. And that is because you're, when you're going through those things for the first time, your body's changing. You don't really know if it's happening to anyone else. So mm-hmm. there are so many stories where someone's like, what's this? When it comes, they have like blood out of their vagina. I mean, that's a slightly like the generation before us, but it's all about like, you immediately attach shame to something that you think is only you. Mm-hmm. And then if you talk about it, it immediately like loses its power. So basically we're just like, what, we want to talk about things that aren't normally spoken about. And we want to ask other people because we want to learn too. So mm-hmm. that's the other crucial thing mm-hmm. about Hotter is that, and Fitter, our shows are like a conversation because we start by interviewing loads of different people with the same questions. So we, the process of making the show is also like finding out mm-hmm. about other people's experience, which is why they're empowering for us too, before mm-hmm. we've even done the show, is mm-hmm. all these amazing conversations yeah. with strangers where they tell you things they've never said before. And the, and then, and it was like a big growth for us, I think, yeah. because we were matured by making it.
Yeah, it's a privilege to hear people put into words something they've never been able to put into words before, because you're met with such honesty that the interviewees give us. Like, we have to do the same thing when we're on stage. Mm-hmm. If we weren't giving all of ourselves and being completely honest about the things we're talking about, then we'd be asking our interviewees to do something that we weren't willing to match them mm-hmm. with. Yeah. And yeah, that's always been so important. And also, like, in our own relationship, now we've reached a point where, like, we will say anything out loud because there's always something relatable about it. Like, you're never the only one who's thought that about yourself. And, like, it's a burden lifted.
Well, it feels kind of like an exorcism. Like, the show itself, you feel so light after it because you're like, everything I've ever felt ashamed of has been completely just pulled out of my body and I'm fine and we're all dancing now and it's great.
Right. And then for people who haven't seen the show, can you just give us a quick overview of what it is?
Hotter, our first show, is we basically interviewed women and trans people aged 11 to 97 with the same set of questions.
And we were asking questions about, like, yeah, around hotness. The first mm-hmm. question was, would you rather be hot or cold? And then from all their answers, so it's verbatim theatre, like we stitched together recordings of people, or what people say inspires like a song. It's quite a hard show to describe because it's somewhere between, like, confessional, verbatim, dance, theatre, with, like, songs that we've made up. There aren't really any rules apart from that we need to have, like, fun doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be really inclusive, so you want to get as many different sorts of bodies and voices in there. And it's got to be, like, a ride. Like, that's the other mm-hmm. thing. Like, when we first made it, we, like, drew it out. So we had this idea of, like, where we want, what we want the audience to feel, and, like, where you want to be, like, feel, like, elevated and where it, like, crashes down. We just knew that it had to, like, make you feel, like, the days when you feel shit about yourself mm. and, like, crawling, skin crawling, and for the end to feel like when the you're, best. Like, dancing on your own in your room. And you just feel amazing. We always struggle to explain it. Even because we really should have gotten better at it. It's like 3 years. And every time someone asks the question, I'm like, eek. I really wish we had a set response.
But I think that's the thing, because that's why I think people like it, is because it is difficult to explain, because it's not like a play and it's not really a mm-hmm. cabaret show. It's like a really weird mixture of like loads of stuff.
It's like an emotional roller coaster, yeah, really. And it is. Like you said, you do feel like you've so captured the perfect essence of the days where you feel like shit about yourself, and then the days you feel really good, and especially the moments where you talk about your relationship. Could you talk a bit more about that? Like, when you were putting a relationship into it, did that come, was that immediately something you wanted to do, or was it, did it develop?
Good question. Very good question. So, we've been doing Hotter for 3 years, and the first year, when we were sort of doing the initial round of interviews, we've added interviews each time, but the first round we had just started sleeping with each other, we were making the show, and then before we went up to Edinburgh for the festival, we broke up,
And so we didn't have any of our own story in that iteration of the show because, like, wow, it was just too difficult. Like, it was the elephant in the room of, like, that entire show was, like, it was, like, yeah, great. There's, like, interviews. It's, like, really fun and interesting. But, like, why are you two making this show?
We didn't realise that was important, though. Like, it wasn't until we'd done a whole Fringe and we had people, like, friends giving us feedback. Mm. They were, like, we just want to know about why you are making it. And I think when you start out making stuff as an artist of any description, definitely for us the fear was like, why would anyone care about us? That's some of the motive for interviewing other people, is that you're like, you're giving outwards, a platform to loads of voices. It's not just about like what we think about our bodies. And then it was really interesting that the main feedback we were getting was like, we just don't understand why it's you two that's making it. So it hadn't really crossed our minds to include the relationship in it. But
it was a combination of like, we'd just broken up, so it was probably too difficult to talk about it. It was hard.
I don't think we thought it was relevant.
I think when you're first starting off like writing a show, you're always like putting the attention onto something else in order to help. Because you're like, I don't have anything interesting to say about myself. Let's talk about these other people.
It's so interesting to hear you say that, because now I think one of my favourite devices you use in the show is the fact that you essentially wouldn't think you are characters in the show, and then you look around and you are. Does that make sense? You know, I think you're hearing all of these other stories and it's you two being like, we're doing these stories, and then you're like, oh no, the story is about you too.
Yeah,
and it's about everyone, and I think it's really special the way you've weaved that in.
And it turned into one of those things where, you know, I was saying earlier about we had to match the honesty of the people we interviewed. We're like, well, we need to talk about the truth behind it. So we came back to Edinburgh the next year with like that whole through line threaded in about us, and like
and the reason the texts were in there, that was this really strange year. We'd both just like finished uni, but Elle was at drama school, I was like working in a cafe, and now we were only meeting on Sundays at Elle's drama school. So it was really like bitty sort of work on it, and we weren't seeing each other very much, and then we'd have these really intense Sundays in a room
looking back through old texts.
Wow.
Yeah. Like sitting next to each other, scrolling back into like
looking
history.
Looking back through my journal.
That's getting like quieter and quieter.
It was hellish. Always when I'm like punishing myself will read old texts. Yes. I'm like, what the fuck does that? Yeah. And the fact that you did that together in a room that's like, that's like a fever dream. Like, wow.
In fact, we did it the other day. I had to look through my old journals the other day for another thing we're working on. And like, oh my God, it's so hard to read back through that time, because I was also chronically depressed, which is another like element in the whole melting pot, which didn't help, you know. And it's so hard going back and reading through your old self, but also nice in a way, because we sit now and we can talk about it, and we can talk about how difficult it was, which I know, you know, lots of people can't do, and there's like unresolved trauma there.
And then I think sort of stage three of the show that you now see at like Soho Theatre is that we then got a director. So then you're not doing that stuff on your own.
Yeah.
Which is the main thing, because we were sort of like, that could go so drastically wrong, what we were trying to do now, I think, that we were like in a room just us two sort of trying to dissect our relationship, and actually all it would do was like make us go really quiet and then go home in a weird mood. And then we got our director, Jess Edwards, who's like an amazing combination of like dramaturg and therapist, because she can like hold a space for you to talk about stuff like that. Ask and like our first questions. Like rehearsal with her, she asked us to do this insane thing, which was write down 5 things you've never said to the other one.
Which for us is like really hard, because we tell each other like fucking loads, like incessantly.
It's just such a testament to the two of you that you could be in a relationship, that relationship to split, and then like 3 years on, you're sitting in a room together and have had a really successful run of this show and can have this conversation now. I think if I'm just thinking of all like my past relationships, and I'm like, my skin is oh my God.
My ex sends me a meme, I like throw my phone at the wall. Jesus.
Yeah. I think part of it is what you said there, is that like I think it's only possible because it's successful. Like I think like basically that's true.
The show.
It's only put ourselves in those positions because we're like, this is gonna be, when I say successful, it's like things are successful when it resonates with people.
Yeah.
And like having an ex like will resonate with people, and the awkwardness, especially in queer relationships, yeah, of like often carrying on in friendship groups with like lots of ex dynamics like unfolding. Exactly. And so, you know, it would be awful if we'd done all that and then no, it didn't like connect with anyone. Yeah. It wouldn't have been worth it. But the reason why we keep going out there and like and challenging ourselves to be braver and braver, and even braver in our new show, Fitter, is because we know that people are going to relate to it in some way.
Yeah.
Would you be happy to tell us a bit about Fitter?
Yes. So Fitter started a bit as a joke because as Hotter's audiences grew and kind of diversified, we'd sometimes have men come up to us and be like, why didn't you interview any men for this? And we'd be like, it's not about you.
Like, there's so much media from the last 500 years. It's all about you. Don't worry.
You've had quite a lot of plays. Like, shut up.
Like, because with Hotter, it's just women
and trans people. Yeah,
and it's so, everyone apart from cis men. That's yeah, sort of the rule.
Right, yeah, right. That's the rule.
We did like 11. Like, we sometimes toyed with it, but we were just like, nah.
Yeah, it's just sort of like, no, it's not your space, and this has to be.
And we don't want to talk to you.
Yeah, we didn't want to talk to them, but they're super hard to ignore. So. And then we sort of started as a joke, being like, well,
let's make a whole fucking show about
men. Let's make a whole show about men. And we were like, oh, we should make a whole show about men. Because we realised mainly that we brought a lot of preconceptions to Fitter, and like even the idea, I mean, it was literally a joke. And we needed to unpack that, be like, well, why do we find it so funny, the idea that we as queer women would make a show about cis men.
And it's about men and their bodies, right?
Like, yeah, it's, yeah. I mean, it's
sexuality,
not just
yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's not just about cis men either. We interviewed boys, men, trans men, cis men, masculine presenting people.
And what were the kind of preconceived notions you went into the show with?
So one joke we had is we won't have any material because we'll ask questions and they'll all just be like, oh, I haven't thought about it before. And you just have a whole show of people being like, don't know. So that was one that people wouldn't like open up in the same way, and I guess the other one was that we wouldn't come across like anywhere near as much self-awareness, which in some ways is true. What we didn't expect actually was that the raw audio material of Fitter weighs a ton. It's so heavy on its own.
Mm-hmm. It's so sad.
Not necessarily because it's like outwardly sad, but because there's like a disjoint between, sometimes that's the case, but a lot of the time it's like someone saying something they felt about themselves without the sort of relief of knowing where it might have come from. So at least with like women, if someone was talking about feeling bad about their body, they've like sort of processed it in some way, or they've spoken to someone about it.
You've had a
it,
lifetime
aware,
to kind of unpack it, as well, because the conversation around women's bodies has been happening much louder and for a lot longer, whereas I think men have only recently been given a platform to talk about like their emotions and their bodies and all the things that
because
come with that.
Because also a lot of the movement of like women talking about their bodies has been anti-male gaze, and they're not really welcomed into that discourse of like self-love. Like, it's kind of, you know, you don't hear men talk about self-love.
Well, there's like, I mean, it breaks my heart that there isn't really like a kind of body positivity for men at the moment. Like, I feel like I am constantly trying to find a space where men are allowed to celebrate their bodies and be body positive, but it doesn't seem to be there yet. I haven't, or at least I haven't found it. Yeah. You know, there are people obviously trying, but it does feel like there's this very, it's very just overwhelmingly sad that they haven't been given permission, essentially.
Yeah, but it's in the shadow of feminism, isn't it? Yeah. So, like, right now, to be entirely male body positive feels like you would have to sort of forget what bodies like yours have meant for women, I think. There's something about it in the link to feminism, I think, that means that it is really hard right now to be like, woohoo, I love being a man. Because that's of course you do. Like, we live in a patriarchy. The feminism thing is like you're lifting the roof off of like oppression that you felt and being like, woo, we can raise the roof if this is so simple. Yeah. Whereas if you're doing it as a man, you're like, well, you didn't even have a roof there. But they do, because there's so much silence. There's actually way more silence about like how you feel in your body, because it's just meant to be all sorted.
And that's where like masculine norms come in and toxic masculinity, because it's not seen as masculine to talk about emotions in that way and to be soft or to be
vulnerable.
Yeah.
To the point, this is I think what makes the Fitter material sad, that goes to a point at which it's not just about talking about feelings, like they actually talk about feeling less. Wow. Like, it's not just about what you say. Like, if you grow up learning not to talk about feelings, there is eventually a knock-on thing where I think it makes you feel less. Like, we've had conversations where it's just like, I don't have that experience of feeling. That's what we were coming across. There are like questions about crying in it, and loads of members just being like, I don't really do that.
Yeah,
but it's, I think not, that is so physiological.
It's not coming from, I think my preconception was like, oh yeah, boys don't cry and we're going to hear that over and over again. Mm-hmm. The thing that's scary was that it's not an active decision not to cry. It's not like I'm going to suppress that feeling in order to not cry. It's like, I can't. Like, it was not even in my emotional vocabulary
to consider
that as an option.
I remember reading a statistic once that baby boys are more likely to learn to not cry. I'm absolutely butchering this. Basically because they realised that their parents were less likely to respond to them crying were they to, like, a female counterpart. And so baby boys cry less, if that's the way you've been conditioned and raised, because they've learned that their parents won't come if they cry. So I feel like that just continues through adult life for most men, unfortunately, because they've just been conditioned that way.
And I thought that was kind of like a... part of me was like, well, how much of that is a stereotype? Like, boys must cry, like, a little bit, maybe.
Yeah,
but
I
like,
cry all the time. Like, literally,
I can't imagine a world in which, like, I cry daily. Like,
and I love
almost nonstop. Yeah. And I've just paused my crying now to do this podcast.
but thank you so much for fitting us in. The crying schedule is actually
I'm just
packed.
Silently weeping during to the listener. But no, so many of the men we spoke to just said, I haven't cried since I was a child. Or like, I can't remember when I last cried. Or my grandma died last year and I didn't cry at all. And I'm sort of like, oh my God.
Yeah. It's madness.
It's so interesting that it runs so much deeper than just the kind of... Yeah, it runs deeper than you'd expect it would. God.
And the other thing that Fitter was about, so that was sort of like the interview side.
Right.
And then we were thinking, the other sort of like big question was like, how is Fitter going to be about us? Because it's really obvious how we fit into the world of Hotter. Because we share something about these bodies. And obviously, we also share things about male bodies. But... It's like we're taking a step further in listening to someone different, and then how does it literally affect our relationship? Thinking about how the interviewees and us in Hotter, there's this like sort of like ping pong world where our relationship is being influenced by the voices you hear, and we were thinking about how that works with like men, and that's when we came across, because like actually. The very few conflicts that we've like had, I mean, they can't even really be called conflicts. They're like deep conversations, but they have like often been about men because of like comparison and desire. And it's so frustrating to us that like that plays into our dynamic, but it still does.
Yeah.
And then the flip side of that is that sort of like competitive desire. And the other way that men have impacted the way we relate is heartbreak because I had like a big heartbreak this year and talked about it non-stop. And Elle had to like, you know, help me through it.
It's about
Of being annoyed that I even felt.
Well, I think because my relationship with men is like super, everything's always fucking complex, isn't it? It's never simple.
Yeah.
But I really shut myself off to men for like a lot of reasons growing up, whether that's like a trust thing or like literal like reasons to do with assault, which are like very difficult to talk about. And so I've never experienced heartbreak because like I've, especially at the hands of a man, like I've never let myself feel vulnerable around a man, basically, is like the long and short of it. And so when you're like nursing a friend through heartbreak and like the idea of heartbreak is sort of completely inaccessible to you, there is a part of you that you're like, why can't you look at this rationally? Like, he's not good enough for you. And the fact that he's not good enough for you is evidenced by the fact that he is not currently here. And so I tended to have, like, on one hand, like, a kind of intellectual, cynical kind of outlook on it, but at the same time, like, just how do you help your best friend, like, mend?
Yeah.
Is it even possible? Like, there are moments where you think it's just not possible. And well, so it's also a kind of about that as well.
Mm-hmm. I think it's so interesting because you can't help someone mend, you can just be there. You know what I mean? It's like, you can't, someone won't be ready until they're ready.
Which is what I struggled with, I think. I struggled with because I was sort of like, I'm going to help you fix this and these are the mantras of it. And it's like, actually, no, you just need to take your time. But that's so frustrating, isn't it?
Oh, it's so frustrating. Yeah. It's also so alarming when you're, especially if you've been wary of men, and then you do let someone in, a man in, and you're like, why did I? Why?
Yeah, why did I
and
do
then,
that?
And then it's equally more frustrating when you're looking at your best friend and you're like, you're so amazing. Like, why did you let this person come in? You know what I mean? Yeah. It's that kind of, it's just a nightmarish, vicious cycle of kind of being like, but why did you even make yourself vulnerable in the first place? Like, I hate that you're hurting, but I hate that you've let someone hurt you.
Yes, that's it.
Totally it. I now have this thing, like, when I'm, if I'm, like, sleeping with, I mean, do I feel like this about women? I don't think I do. I haven't had this experience with women. But if I sort of, like, feel myself starting to like a guy, I feel like what I'm doing is I'm sort of about to hand them, like, some power over me. And I'm like, the second I hand this to you, you're gonna break it. Like, basically,
I'm holding myself.
I'm giving you something which I know you're going to crack.
Yeah.
Which isn't always true, but that's, like, how I now think about it. And you're like, this is awful. Even desiring you is giving you the power to, like, get to me. Because now if you want someone else, I'm going to feel, like, hurt. Mm. Or if you go, like, get a bit bored of this, I'm going to feel really hurt. So I'm basically handing you, like, some sort of sledgehammer and then my, like, soft little ego. And you've got the sledgehammer and I've given you my soft little ego. Mm. I've given you a bit of it and you... It's just a time bomb. It's like, in a moment, you're just going to smash it. Yeah. When are you going to thwomp it? That feeling is horrible.
It feels like the more you hand it over, the more cracked the ego gets anyway. So it's kind of even worse because even if they don't hurt you, you've already planned for it. You've already penciled in the, you know, despair. You can't help that.
You're so right. Penciling in the despair is like an excellent phrase for that.
Yeah.
Because then there's like a bit of you holding back. I think that's my relationship with men is that I perpetually pencil in the despair.
It's so we recently interviewed Chidera, the sunflower, and it's so interesting hearing kind of the contrasting ways that people have relationships with men, because I think it is a big part, and I think it also does play into a lot with our relationships with our bodies as well, especially how we view ourselves through the way men look at us. But see, I much more relate to what you two are saying. No, I love Chidera, I think she's amazing, but we had a very interesting conversation about it, where you see the kind of people have learned different ways to cope and survive the sledgehammering, basically.
Well, yeah, I think that's just it. It's like how people have learned to navigate all of these dynamics in different ways. And I think she's taken one extreme.
Yeah. But it's a very interesting one.
The other game we both play, I think, is that when you're not handing someone your soft ego, the way that you can avoid doing that is by like turning the tables and like hunting men. Mm. So we both know this in like a sort of casual sex way that you're like, I know you fancy me. And that sort of, that confidence in someone fancying you pretty much only comes when you know they haven't got your soft ego. Like the stakes, you're not about to lose something really like precious to you. And so that's when you can really see attraction really clearly, I think, is when you haven't got your own like stake in it. But then when you see like a man fancies you, then you're like, this is really easy. I know what I can do. Like basically, we talk about this a lot. You're like, I already know we're going to have sex.
Yeah.
Because I've decided and I can just feel that this is just going to happen now.
Yeah.
So there's that game which stops you from handing your ego over.
Yeah.
Because you're sort of detached from it and you're playing the thing like a game. And that's why it feels
really... Does that make you feel masked when you do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is like a mask way of fucking. And that's also the time...
It makes you feel so powerful.
Yeah. And it's also the time when you're like... Those are sort of the only occasions where I'm like, okay, I'm going now. Yeah. We've had sex, I'm leaving. It's like 2 a.m. but I'm not gonna sleep in your bed. Or you're like, well, the one in the morning, you're just like, bye.
I've
or like, you need to leave.
Like, yeah, you need to go.
Yeah,
like, sorry, we're done.
On the way.
Yeah. Like, bye.
I've already booked an Uber, yeah.
But that's the way in which, like, I think I'm gonna muddle my way through this thought. The act of like performing on stage, we spoke about this a lot when we were rehearsing and writing. Like, almost there's something about the act of performing on stage that is sort of mask. And I'm going to try and unpack this because it's a power thing of being like, everyone is here to see me. And I'm going to sit back in it and just assume that everyone's listening.
I imagine it's how most, like, straight, cis, white men feel all the time. Just like when they turn up to an event, they're like, everyone's here for me. And you're like, I'm this is my birthday.
Weirdly, even though you're putting in loads of effort and, like, into the act of performing, really you're not having to do anything at all because they're coming to you. And then also the act of like filtering your emotions, and there are points in the show where we talk about like super difficult things, but the act of like filtering them down into like a pulp that is presentable on stage. Basically, in order to perform, you have to put up some kind of facade even when you are presenting your most like raw, you know, quote unquote vulnerable self. There is a level at which you are having to kind of hold a version of yourself like there, and that feels quite mask, and it also feels like very powerful because you're letting them come to you XYZ. It made me feel so like in control and powerful while we were
performing. There's also something about like the boxer to it, because you're being like, there's one way of looking at you, like, oh, these people say these amazing like emotional vulnerable letters about themselves every day. And then the experience of doing that though is a little bit like getting ready for like a boxing match, because the vulnerability is your strength. So in some ways you're being like, look how fucking strong I am, I can say this letter every day. Although I'm exposing a vulnerability, I'm also being like, I can handle this, I process this in some way. I might be crying while I read this thing, but I'm getting up every day and doing it. So there is a sort of like macho bravado in a weird way that I feel of being like, now I'm sitting on my box, I'm going to tell 90 people something that like most people would be really terrified to say. There's vulnerability wrapped in there's strength wrapped in the vulnerability.
Well, it's interesting because it kind of feels like a complete reclamation of vulnerability and a rebranding, because I think for so long things that were considered typically masculine were very, you know, like macho bravado, but actually I think the real strength is coming from the vulnerability, and that's actually what scares people now. It's terrifying to people that you can get up there and look someone like dead dumb, you know, you can stare at them and be like, just so you know, I've had a wank, like that's terrifying to people. They're like, that honesty is so frightening and so brave, and it's interesting that we're even considering that as mask because it's powerful, but actually it's a typically inherently feminine thing, or it's like that's what we've been branded as, is the emotional ones. So like reclaiming that and being like, no, this is powerful as hell is very fucking cool.
But that's like something I'm always kind of tripping over myself and saying, because I've just like done that whole, you know, talk about how being performing is mask. But I think I'm just using mask as synonymous with powerful, which is like inherent, it's just wrong. Like, I shouldn't have to feel like I'm becoming something else in order to feel powerful.
But it's also interesting about that sliding scale of feeling masculine and feeling feminine. Like, it is something that, like, we all have days where I have days where I feel more mask than I feel femme. Like, it's very interesting, but it's not something that we talk about at all, really, in our day-to-day lives. And I like that you two are unpacking that.
Well, just that you can draw on both, like, energies. So, like, one thing that happens is before Hotter, we do this, like, in the preset, we do this big femme, like, posy dance to, like, Lizzo in, like, pink light, and we're in our, like, costumes. And so we spend the time before the show starts doing this, like, femme hair flicking, nail checking, and, like, bum moving stuff,
and it's
like
warm.
15 minutes,
it's
and it's
warm.
So fun, and you're so that's where that performance energy comes from. And then before Fitter, we are behind the like blacks, so in the shadows, the audience can't see us, but we're still dancing, except we're in suits and we're both dancing in like a mask way.
My hands are in my pockets.
The energy like, that we're like
nodding really fervently.
The energy that we're building up is like a different thing,
but
it comes from the same. It just, it's a different, sort
kind
of fire.
Up,
But there is something about mask and effort, I think. Mask movement, I think, is about like not showing often effort. Like when you see guys dance in the club, it's sort of like, I'm not even trying to dance, but I am.
Yeah.
And then they're like, well, femme camp version. Yeah.
It'd be humiliating.
Yeah. And then like femme camp queer culture is like voguing, well, where it's like, I am like fucking working so hard. So that difference we like really felt, I think.
Well, it's interesting with like, because I know a lot of people who do Vogue and in ballroom culture, and like with, so you have Vogue Femme, which is very soft, and the idea is to be soft and cunt. Like that's the ethos you want to create.
And
you
also
want
just
to
doing
create
the
feminine, yeah, because you want to create feminine lines. Uh-huh. Whereas when they'll do like All American Runway, that is mask, and it is like hard. There's no hip, there's no softness to it. It's hard and it's.
I can't do it. I love hearing you say cunt. It was the most exciting thing I've had all day. I was like, I don't normally swear. But it's part of the vocabulary.
Yeah.
Then it becomes allowed. I love that word.
I want to go back to the show. So I'm a researcher, and so I do lots of interviews as part of some of my work. And so then, and when you're talking about all the interviews and the range from like from children to people in their 90s is so fascinating to me, and hearing how they speak about bodies. And I just wonder if you've got anything that has really stood out to you or has changed your thinking over the course of the years that you've been doing those interviews and doing the show.
Yeah, what was one kind of very eye-opening tidbit that you got? Because we probably have
or something that you're like just stuck on that just is like that'll stay with you.
I think mostly it's like the older people we've interviewed. So for me, I interviewed my grandma Pommy for Hotter, and like her interview is sort of like the heart of the show. And the kind of equivalent in Fitter is Mr. Hamilton, who's 102 years old.
Wow.
And it's hard to explain how it feels interviewing someone who has just lived that long. And like, I kind of look at them from my 23 years and I think, I'm so, you know, we know so much from talking to so many people, and like, I really feel like I'm discovering things. And then like, I see what they've lived through, and you know, there's just a kind of casualness to being old, and like, well, it's made me appreciate like the functionality of my own body.
Yeah.
My grandma was like really unwell when we interviewed her, and she was like sort of losing use of it like altogether. And so there's a kind of gratefulness to it. I'm really excited to like be old, and there's like a fear of growing old, and I'm like, I want that wisdom, man.
Also just the comfort, I think, of being old and just truly being like, I've lived in this body for so long and this is my home. And I think you just feel so much more settled. Like, you look at older people and I think when they've really... I think there's an age where you're freaking out and you're like, no, my body, like, no, I'm losing my body. And then I think there's a comfort in going, actually, I'm letting myself age. I've given myself permission and I'm here. I think that's very powerful.
I think... And then it becomes a different thing, though. So, like, Mr. Hamilton, for example... He spoke about being lonely. And so there's a part of me that's like, yeah, that was our reaction too. Just like, heart, like, just heartbreaking. Yeah. And there's a part of me that really looks forward to, you know, gracefully growing old and like just growing.
Well, messily.
Because like you forget, but like you, you know, growing old, you're still growing, you know? But then talking to Mr. Hamilton, there is a slightly terrifying aspect to it, because he's so lonely. But as my granddad used to say, it's better than the alternative, which is death.
So Mary, do you maybe want to give us a little
out?
Also, there's no pressure to, if you've got a good heavy one, please by all means.
I don't think it's not heavy. I was thinking about someone we interviewed called Katie, and is like a wheelchair user, and I had this like long discussion with her about bodies, and one thing that really struck me was she was sort of being like, I knew that other people found my like scoliosis disgusting. But then much earlier than I think lots of people get a grip on it, she was basically like, because I realised so early on, I'm never going to look like that person. There's like a rebellious energy that then like fuels her self-love. And I think I was a sort of like lazy expecting that would be like a continuing problem, that you'd be like, oh, I don't know if I like feel beautiful because I don't map onto the ways, the things that I see. And actually what I encountered was the complete opposite, which was like, no, there's a freedom in this because no one's presenting me, like the way people see me, it can't impact me because I know who I am. And we came across a sort of similar thing with Fitter, where like people that had disabilities that made them look physically different from other people tended to have like a really like actually much more like stronger resilience. There's a danger in looking more like the people you see in magazines in any way, race or like body form, because actually then it becomes this thing that you drive towards and you don't then develop the like rebellious instinct.
Whereas you get to decide what's beautiful if you don't fit the traditional narrative.
Yeah,
you get to go, I like this about myself. Yeah. I think this is beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, that really makes me think of two things. It makes me think of you when we're talking about Love Island one time.
I was just thinking about that.
Well, because I remember asking you, like, do you feel bothered by watching, like, you, like, I don't watch Love Island, but you watch it all the time, and I'm like, do you not find it a bit, like, oppressive, or, like, because you've got all these, like, perfect bodies, and you're like, no, they're, like, CGI models, it's, like, it's so far removed.
I literally just listened to that episode.
Oh, really? Yeah, but I think that pulls that back to me, so it's a way of thinking. And then the other thing you were saying, so with my research centre, part of it is looking at people who have got visible difference, and actually you do see that in the research, that actually people who do have an appearance that is different to the norm can have this like resilience that they've maybe had to build up, but once they've got it, it's fiery and strong, and I think that's really powerful, and I think something for all of us to kind of learn from.
I think to learn that like being different from the norm is a sort of, it can be a sort of freedom, obviously. Comes with a whole host of things that are not about being a privileged body that would be like difficult. There's the other thing, which is like to not shroud whole groups of people in like vague clouds of pity, because actually they might know something about closer to being free from the sort of like structures that you're a slave to than you will ever know, because they know something, they've sorted something out about why not to care about what other people think way before it takes the rest of us motherfuckers to get there, because you're like, you might be like 80 before you're like, maybe I just shouldn't listen to other people. And if you've always been different, then I think like there's an accelerating thing where you're like young, you're like, fuck this, I can't. I'm going to spend the rest of my life feeling shit about this if I don't just like learn that getting over this now is good. That's my like uplifting thing.
No, I think that's really good.
That's a well done. Perfect way to really a perfect ending note. No saving needed.
Obviously, we could talk to you all day. Where can we find you on social media?
Oh, we're at Hotter Project on Instagram and on Twitter.
Yeah, that's basically
anything
it.
Anything else?
It?
That's basically anything it. Else? My number is.
A Tinder. Yeah. How can be found on Tinder and Tinder and
all
Bumble.
Genders. Well.
Thank you for listening to the Body Protest podcast.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode. It would mean the world to us if you could subscribe, rate and review.
You can follow Honey on Instagram at HoneyKinney.
And you can follow Nadia at Nadia.Craddock.
This podcast is edited by the angels at Project Harness, Daisy and Rasheen.
And brought to you by the Pink Protest Podcast Network.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.